This is
Cyber Station USA.
I warn you, their ingenuity goes hand in hand with their technology.
I think it's fair to call this hostile territory.
For you, I'll make an exception.
What you hold in your hand is the proof of their power.
Come here. You're not hurt, right?
We're back to the Neil Haley Show, and you know, when I talk about foundations and charities, that's one thing. When I started in radio, I said, you know what, I want to highlight great people who are doing great things. I don't want to continually always bring people down. Some of the network does that. We do that in all of the 10,000 hours of radio I've done or more, but it's something that's important. But this guy's doing great things, and I get excited when I have these interviews. So I'm excited to welcome to the program Kurt Lindsley of Go Purple USA. Kurt, thanks for calling. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing great. Great to be with you this evening.
Absolutely. It's fantastic to talk to you. And let's kind of literally just jump really specifically into your background, because I was reading up on it. You really have a lot of experience working with foundations and charities, because that's key component when you try to help others. You got to raise money, that's for sure.
That is true. That's part of being able to make a difference, is that component, definitely.
Absolutely. So let's kind of go into, you know, when we talk about that specifics, how did you get involved in that? What was your background to get involved in helping others with charities and foundations that got you towards that journey, your background?
Yeah, so back in the early 2000s, I was the chairperson of a commission in Covington, Washington, which is a city that's a suburb of Seattle. And the commission that I served on, I was on part of that commission for about 3 years. And what we did is we received grant applications from a number of nonprofits in our community. We had them come and they'd filled out a detailed application. We'd have them come and make a presentation to our commission. And in many cases, we went out and did site visits. So we did kind of a deep dive. And really the focus or the purpose of our commission was to decide how to divvy up this pot of money that the city had set aside for a variety of different nonprofits and human services. Issues that really came to the forefront for me, and it was really apparent as we really did these deep dive situations, look at all these nonprofits and the needs in our community, was that the three of the organizations that we chose to fund were domestic violence related. There was a domestic violence shelter that was the main one in our community. There was a crisis line, and there was also a sexual assault resource center that provided advocacy support.
Oh, wow.
And I just became aware of this being a problem that was so much bigger in scope than I could ever have imagined. And the thing that really broke my heart is that the vast majority of people that were in a domestic violence situation that needed to flee, there was not the resources, there wasn't enough shelter space for them. And so it really became a big problem or an issue to try to help resolve that aspect of it. Anyway, that led to me co-founding the Covington Domestic Violence Task Force back in 2004 to begin working on some events in our community, raising awareness of education, and working on some programs to raise funds to help address that issue of, you know, having adequate bed nights to help for people that were fleeing domestic violence.
So when you talk about, so when you talk about domestic violence, kind of go into that in a little bit more of greater detail, what made you passionate to go in towards and try to help people based on that?
Well, I mean, I've known people that have gone through that. But the thing that really became apparent to me is when I learned about how extensive this problem was, one out of four women and one out of nine men in the United States are going to experience domestic violence at some time in their lifetime. And to me, when I think about that, that is just so sobering. I mean, it literally, the word that always comes to my mind is epidemic when I think about that. And it's like every person, you know, every person that we may pass along the street, they are going to know people just by virtue of the statistics. They're going to know people who've been affected by domestic violence. And it just is a... It's such an overwhelming issue that really there's not enough resources going to the problem. There really needs to be a lot more awareness, raising the awareness of engaging communities to get involved to do something about this, and really kind of the nature of a domestic violence relationship. The person who is the victim, typically, or the survivor, is often made to feel isolated and alone and really doesn't have in many cases, doesn't have a voice. Yeah. So it takes people that are will come alongside and that really will show that they care and help to provide support for people that are going through that, and really just kind of raising the awareness in our communities that this is a huge problem. It impacts so many different aspects of society. And it's personal because all of us know people that have gone through domestic violence. We may not know specifically individuals, but when you consider that statistic, one out of four women and one out of nine men, you know, all of our lives are impacted by this problem.
So when we talk about domestic violence in so many ways, it's not just towards women, it's men too. It's become more and more men have dealt with some sort of domestic violence as well, right?
That's correct. Yeah, the and actually, in many cases, it happens just in the home when people are growing up. You know, for boys and girls get exposed to it. But yeah, it's a serious problem for men. I mean, that's a pretty significant number when you're talking about one out of nine men that are impacted by it. So you know, most of the awareness campaigns center around women because they are largely affected on a greater scale, but it really is an epidemic that crosses all socioeconomic demographics, you know, all aspects of society, all races, income levels, really just about all aspects of society we can find this prevalent.
We're seeing a big issue right now in Pittsburgh where a player from the Pittsburgh Steelers, Anthony Ciccolo, has just been accused of domestic violence. And there are people arguing, should he play Sunday or not play Sunday? We've dealt with this with certain athletes and domestic violence. Your thoughts on this zero tolerance that the NFL does compared to other sports?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, the NFL has kind of got a black eye somewhat just in how they've dealt with some of the issues in the past with prior players. There was the issue with Ray Rice that came out where they really had applied a fairly light, you know, repercussions towards him. And then this video came out that showed how extensive the violence was that he committed. And so I think what's positive about it is they're being a lot more proactive about doing something about this and really just kind of helping to uphold the values for society. It's just not acceptable for violence to be taking place in a household. And so I think it's a very positive thing that the NFL and more of our sports leagues and other aspects of society are speaking out and taking a stand in their policies.
Absolutely. And it's something that has to be done for sure, because of, again, how horrible the effects of domestic violence lead to, what types of things, what kind of problems do people that have had dealt with domestic violence in one way, in some way, how, what kind of repercussions end up towards that person, that victim?
Yeah, definitely. That's for sure. What we see typically in a domestic violence situation is the nature of the relationship is the perpetrator is typically very controlling. That's kind of the main characteristic that we see. And so the person who is the survivor who's going through that is made to be isolated. The perpetrator usually kind of woos them and shows attention and affection to be, you know, at the beginning of the relationship. But then they begin by demeaning the person, putting them down, really demeaning their self-worth. They isolate the person from their friends and family. And in so many cases, the person who's going through that really feels helpless and alone. And it impacts all aspects of their lives, not just the physical abuse, but the emotional scars that someone experiences when they go through it really has a deep impact. And in some cases, that's a lot more impactful than even the physical violence that occurs.
Why is verbal violence not considered domestic violence? Or is it? And I'm missing a point.
It is in largely in the nonprofit world that deals with this issue. It's actually kind of considered part of that whole realm because it's typically the pattern of what is sort of the precursor to physical violence. So, so we do consider that part of the issue of that type of a relationship going on, of the demeaning, the yelling, the uncontrolled temper and anger, and just that kind of a relationship. It is something that's real serious because it is a warning sign. It's a red flag oftentimes that there could be domestic violence going on within a relationship.
So tell me about Go Purple USA, how you started that.
Well, the Covington Domestic Violence Task Force that I told you about that we started in 2004, we started an initiative in 2006 in our community called Purple Light Nights. And the idea behind Purple Light Nights is that purple is the color that's associated with the cause against domestic violence internationally. And the month of October, for about 35 years or so, has been recognized as Domestic Violence Awareness Month. And so the idea was for residents, businesses, city government, nonprofits to hang up purple lights at their residences, businesses, city landmarks during the month of October as a way of showing symbolically support for survivors of domestic violence. It began as something that we intended, you know, for our community. Other communities heard about it, and it literally just took off and became a movement across North America. Our Purple Light Nights events have been endorsed by Christine Gregoire, who is formerly the governor of the state of Washington, Dave Reichert, who is a member of the U.S. House of Representatives.
That's right.
Rob McKenna, who is a member of the Washington Attorney General. And this last year, we had official Purple Light Night events in 32 states. In several provinces in Canada, as well as other countries around the world. And we've had it in some large cities across the United States. Houston, Texas, for example, did a major Purple Light Nights campaign where they lit five of the more prominent landmarks in Houston purple and held a press conference there on October 1st as a kickoff to Domestic Violence Awareness Month. And so we've had a lot of communities around the United States that have taken part in that. And then as kind of a step forward, Go Purple USA is a nonprofit that I founded more recently to be intentional in taking our Purple Light Nights campaigns to more communities. And also
we have before us the opportunity to forge a new world order.
There is a man behind the curtain. This isn't the Wizard of Oz. The shake-up to the music business machine.
That sounds fun!
This is a far more deadly predator than anyone ever imagined.
Perfectly designed.
I wonder which came first.
Cyrus Mission USA.
Cyber Station USA is the future of radio. Get your business into the online future at the world's largest internet radio station. From banner placement on our homepage to any of our broadcaster stages, commercials on our video player, audio spots on any of our shows, or at the beginning of any of our on-demand broadcasts. Cyber Station USA offers competitive rates with a worldwide reach, a fully integrated one-stop shop social media broadcast platform. For more information, please contact our sales department at cameo@cyberstationusa.com.
Cameo Entertainment Group and CyberStation USA are now part of Stitcher, a free radio app for your smartphone. With Stitcher, you can listen to live programming as well as archive radio programming right on your phone. To obtain Stitcher, just go to the App Store for your particular phone. Go to search, then type in Stitcher. That's Stitcher. S-T-I-T-C-H-E-R.
S-T-I-T-C-H-E-R.
Then download. It's that simple.
Stitcher,
a free radio app for your smartphone. Convenient access to live and archive CyberStation USA programming on your mobile phone. That's Stitcher.
S-T-I-T-C-H-E-R.
CyberStation USA, always on the go.
Every so often you have technology come along that rewrite the rules of the game.
Digital culture isn't characterized by the home computer.
You speak instantly to a man standing on the shore of France.
The CyberStation, the USA, the .com.
Worldwide. Everything has changed.
A new age.
The biggest ride in all of history.
This is CyberStationUSA.com.
Worldwide.
This is the future.
The future.
Radio.
The future.
The future of radio.
And that really is the message.
We initiated the Go Purple Day, which is a national day on October 1st, where we invite people to wear purple with their coworkers, their friends, their family, to take a photo and share that on social media with the hashtag Go Purple Day, and also the hashtag with their state or their community where they live, that part of the United States or Canada, as raising awareness through social media about the problem with domestic violence and really engaging conversation about this issue. A big component of this also for us, for our campaigns, is letting people know about where local resources are. So it's not just raising the awareness about the issue, about the problem, how extensive the problem is, but about where people can go to get help to deal with it. That's a real important part of our campaigns as well.
Wow. So fantastic. What is your ultimate goal with Go Purple USA?
We want to blanket the United States purple on Go Purple Day on October 1st. We want to raise the awareness across the United States so we have really a movement of people that are taking a stand against domestic violence that we feel that the way to effectuate change is to get more and more people involved in this and just not, given to maybe past values where this issue got swept under the carpet or maybe people thought, well, that's a personal thing with their family. We need to really raise the awareness of this issue and talk about it so that we as a community, in our different communities around the United States can do something about this collectively. And really to communicate the message that domestic violence has no place in our community. There's no reason why somebody needs to be committing violence towards another person. That's not a healthy relationship. And also another part of it is just valuing the worth of people. If people will value the worth of others instead of looking down on them and demeaning them, I feel that can go a long way towards really kind of the values and attitudes that society can have towards something like this that sort of prolongs it, decade after decade, literally, in our country.
Best place we can find more information on you and learn more about you, where can we go?
Yeah, so we have a couple websites that are prominent ones that we utilize to get our message out. GoPurpleUSA.org. Is a great one to refer to. And then we also have a website, which is GoPurpleDay.com. So that talks about the Go Purple Day event. We've also got our pages on social media for Go Purple USA and Go Purple Day on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And we'd love to invite your visitors, your listeners to get involved in this cause. They connect with us through social media, connect with us through our website. We would love to just include them in our campaigns and let them know how they can make a difference in their own homes, in their own communities.
Fantastic, Kurt. I appreciate you calling, and you're doing tremendous work, and I appreciate you coming on the show.
Well, thank you. It's my honor to be on your show tonight. Thank you very much.
Take care. All right. See you later. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye now.
You're listening to Neil Haley's show, and we'll be back in just a moment. Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Neil Haley Show's Author's Corner segment, Miami Book Fair, November 17th to 24th, 22nd to 24th is the street festival. Go to miamibookfair.com for more information. I keep talking about weather changes, and we have one more warm-up, I guess, the semi-one. It's pouring down rain here in Pittsburgh, but I know my studios will be freezing cold as I broadcast live on Sunday, the 24th of November, the Miami Book Fair 10th year with Eric Remmel of Life Improvement Radio. I cannot wait. And I guess 5 or 6 hours we'll be hanging out together, talking to great authors. But we always kick it off by talking to amazing authors all the way to the Miami Book Fair. And when I get into this October time, right before Halloween, I know it's going to get colder and colder. And we could keep getting interesting authors. So I'm excited to welcome to the program Andrea Lawler, author of Paul Takes the Form of a Mortal Girl. Andrea, thanks for calling. How are you?
Oh, I'm great. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So tell us the story of how you became a writer.
Oh, sure. Well, I didn't really start writing until I was 30. Before I was 30, as an undergraduate, I was an English major. I went to the University of Iowa, go Hawks. And I was surrounded by people who were in the Iowa Writers Workshop. So I had this whole idea of writers and, you know, I was interested. I was a reader. I was interested in thinking about books, but I sort of felt like, oh, people like me can't be writers. And I ended up knowing a lot of the people in the workshop because I was a bartender that's a good way to get to know writers, but I ended up meeting a lot of the writers in that way. And then later I worked in publishing in New York. I worked at NYU Press, and I again sort of thought, well, I don't know if I really could be a writer, but I liked being around books, and everything I did was about being around books and writing. And then at some point, a little bit before my 30th birthday, my girlfriend at the time and still to this day said, you know, I don't know why you're in this soul crushing job. You're a writer. And I thought, you know, I should listen to her. Yeah, in general. Yes. That was always been my, you know, way, is to try to listen to good advice. And she was in film school at the time. She's a documentary filmmaker. And I thought, well, I guess if you could go to film school and get an MFA, then I guess I could think about, you know, taking like a writing class. So I took a night class at Gotham in New York, where I was working. I had this job. I was working in a web development company. And so I took this night class, this writing class, which ended up being with the writer Carter Sickles, who's a really amazing writer. And that class was sort of the first time I thought, oh, maybe I could do this. And it wasn't so stressful. It was a lot of like people with day jobs who are just kind of trying this out. And around the time of my 30th birthday, I took an unpaid leave of absence from my job, and I got a place, an off-season room with a friend in Provincetown, Massachusetts, which is like it's very cold in the winter, and it's kind of a resort town, but it's cheap in the off-season.
Right.
And there's a lot of writers there. So I thought, I'll just like take like 2 months and I had a little bit of money saved and I'll just like live cheaply and write and see how that goes. And about a month into that, I got laid off. So that was probably like the best thing that ever happened to me as a writer. Because I got like small amount of severance, like a $1,500. And then I got, New York State unemployment. And so I was getting unemployment, and I realized, you know, and I was like looking for jobs and everything, but I was also writing, and I was like, oh, okay, this is like my emerging writer's grant. And so I ended up actually in San Francisco and working in a bookstore at that point, because I thought, I'm not going back to that the soul crushing job. And I started taking this living room writing workshop with the writer Dodi Bellamy. And then at that point, I started realizing, like, I loved working in the bookstore, which is Dog-Eared Books in San Francisco. And I loved being in San Francisco, but I realized if I wanted to take it further, I was probably going to need to go to graduate school, because I was at that point even having a hard time saying I'm a writer. But I thought if I could say I'm a graduate,
exactly, student, yeah,
like that would be kind of an alibi. So I applied to grad school, and I went to grad school at Temple in Philly, studying with Samuel Delaney. And then I ended up doing another program at UMass, an MFA program at UMass, where I got my MFA finally. And so it took a really long time. You know, when I started what became Paul, it was a short story in that living room workshop in San Francisco in, like, you know, 2002. And it, over the course of like 15 years, I like finished it.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. And while going tons of school. So was it easy for you to get published then?
No, I mean, I don't think it was, I don't think it's ever easy to get published.
No, not at all.
No, around the time I finished my thesis, and Paul was also like, I just kept working on it. Like, I'm just, you know, I'm like, cuss it. I won't give a thing up. I'll just keep going with it. So I just kept going with it, even though people were like, wow, you're still working on that thing. And so I finally did finish it, and it was my thesis. And I was revising that draft around the time my partner had our baby. And so then I was like, okay, I got to get this, you know, I got to send this out. I got to try to get an agent. And I sent it to about, you know, 9 or 10 agents who were mostly the agents of people, you know, my thesis director or people I was friends with, writers I was friends with. And I got from almost all of the agents, I got a request for the full manuscript. So I sent that in. And then I got these very kind, pretty personal rejections. And I started to realize that what the rejections were saying was, you know, I can't sell this book. And I thought, okay, you know, I started sending it to smaller independent presses, which I thought would be great too. And sort of getting similar, really nice rejections. Like, we only do one book of fiction right. a year, and we already have ours. So it's kind of working it through. But at that point, you know, my kid was baby, and I was like, I have to get this off my desk. I think maybe people are done talking about gender in the 90s. So, like, I'll just try. I just got to get it published so I can write another book and stop thinking about it. And around that time, the editors, Hillary Plum and Zach Savage from Rescue Press, contacted me and said, you know, we have this open reading period at Rescue and for prose. And, you know, we know your work. We love your manuscript. Would you send it for us to consider? So I did. And I sent it. And I thought, like, I love small press publishing. I'm just going to do this. I tried the agent route. It didn't happen. So I sent it to them, and, you know, miraculously they were like, we want to do it. And I thought about it, and then it started hitting home, and I was like, this is going to be really tiny. And I thought, okay, but they were really just beautiful writers. Hillary Plum is like one of the best developmental editors working, and she's a gorgeous writer. And I loved everybody who worked at that press, and they had a beautiful design. Like, they made really good looking books, and I'm fairly superficial, so I thought, like, let's do it. Like, you make a good looking book, we're gonna do it. So I said yes, and then the book actually ended up, they put a lot of, you know, they put all their efforts behind it, and it right. got some really good review attention. And there was a nice small review in the New Yorker and some other places. And then I started getting these emails about things like foreign rights and film and TV options. So I contacted okay. one of the agents who had, you know, like, you get these emails and you don't know what to do. And a lot of them are just like, they just send them
exactly.
out, you know, but I didn't know what to do. And so I thought, I'll just email like my top agent crush, which is PJ Mark, who's just like this amazing agent who represents writers I love so much and I really admire. And I'd read an interview with him that made me really like him, and he rejected the book nicely.
Oh,
but I just basically wrote to him, and I was like, look, you know, I know you you didn't want to take this on before, but I thought, you know, if you would even have some advice, or like, I would trust your judgment about who to contact. And he said, you know what, the timing wasn't right before, but let me take another look at it. And then he did take another look at it. And he said, yeah, like, let's do this. I think it had to happen this way.
We have before us the opportunity to forge a new world order.
There is a man behind the curtain. This isn't the Wizard of Oz. The shakeup to the music business machine.
That sounds fun!
This is a far more deadly predator than anyone ever imagined.
Perfectly designed.
I wonder which came first.
CyberStation USA.
CyberStation USA is the future of radio. Get your business into the online future at the world's largest internet radio station. From banner placement on our homepage to any of our broadcaster stages, commercials on our video player, audio spots on any of our shows, or at the beginning of any of our on-demand broadcasts. CyberStation USA offers competitive rates with a worldwide reach, a fully integrated one-stop shop social media broadcast platform. For more information, please contact our sales department at cameo@cyberstationusa.com.
Cameo Entertainment Group and CyberStation USA are now part of Stitcher, a free radio app for your smartphone. With Stitcher, you can listen to live programming as well as archive radio programming right on your phone. To obtain Stitcher, just go to the App Store for your particular phone. Go to search, then type in Stitcher. That's Stitcher. S-T-I-T-C-H-E-R.
S-T-I-T-C-H-E-R.
Then download. It's that simple. Stitcher, a free radio app for your smartphone. Convenient access to live and archive CyberStation USA programming on your mobile phone. That's Stitcher.
S-T-I-T-C-H-E-R.
CyberStation USA, always on the go. Every so often you have technology come along that rewrite the rules of the game.
Digital culture isn't characterized by the home computer.
You speak instantly to a man standing on the shore of France.
The CyberStation, the USA, the .com.
Worldwide.
Everything has changed.
A new age.
The biggest ride in all of history.
This is CyberStationUSA.com.
Worldwide.
This is the future.
The future.
Radio.
The future.
The future of radio.
And that really is the message.
Because of the kind of book it is. And so he's been amazing. And then he worked out a situation where Vintage Knopf did a reprint of it in the US, and then Picador, it came out as a new book in Picador in the UK. And so Rescue, then the small press that had gotten me to that point, then like continues to benefit from that. So they get, you know, they get part of the royalties there. And that's like really awesome because they publish really innovative work that doesn't, you know, so it supports that other work that's getting published.
So that's a fantastic story.
It's wild, right?
It's a great story. And to get
sorry,
to that
it's
point.
It's like the whole time.
No, that's okay. I don't mind. I want good stories. I want good radio. And a good, you know, a good media. And so I have no problem with that story, but that's a great one because ultimately you got rejected, yet went your own way, said, hey, this is my passion, got published by somebody else. And then the person who rejected you said, nah, well, I want you now because you're popular. This is how it works. It truly does. It truly is. And then when certain, you know, agents or different people say, no, thank you, it's because you don't have a built-in audience. That's the honest to gosh truth. And if you have success, that everyone surrounds themselves with success. Am I right or wrong?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and I think one of the things that's interesting is the way that small press publishing right now can take chances that big press, you know, the big five can't always take chances.
No, they can't because it's all
on
about
a work that doesn't fit, you know,
because they have investors. Meaning they have, it's a public company. If you're not going to produce and you're losing money, they're thinking of closing that publisher down, right? We see all the newspapers going, so they can't take chances that an independent publisher. Look at the stories in films, right? You see specifically small films or small Netflix projects or certain things. It's not going to do anything. And it blows up. And then everyone that rejected them are like, see? Now, look at you now. Look at me now. You were wrong.
Totally.
And it always happens. So tell us just a quick synopsis of the book. Sure. But a great story of how you got published. And I love it. It's especially, a labor of love, the opportunity.
Definitely. Well,
go ahead. I'm here.
Okay. So the book is, follows the adventures of Paul Polidorus, who's at the start of the book, he's a 23-year-old queer college student at University of Iowa. You know, where do I get this stuff?
University of Iowa, because you brought that up earlier.
Yeah, Well, but he, the thing about Paul Polidorus is that he's a shapeshifter. So it's a kind of a coming of age story, and it's set in the 90s, and there's a lot of stuff about music and the kind of like queer cultural world of the 90s. But there's this extra thing, which is Paul can change his body at will. So, you know, he takes different forms and sometimes, you know, goes into different situations. And it's been described as a picaresque, like a road trip sort of a book where Paul is in Iowa City and New York and San Francisco and Provincetown and Michigan Women's Music Festival and all of these different locations that were sort of hotbeds of like queer life in the 90s, particularly. And I think one of the reasons that it was tough for the bigger publishers to see as viable in the first round of sending it out was because there's a lot of sex in it, because when Paul is, you know, Paul's 23 and able to change his body. So, you know, what do you do? Like you just have sex with a lot of different people. And so it's sort of like exploring that kind of sexuality and body, you know, understandings of body and gender and sexuality in a way that may be a little more playful than other kinds of stories.
But we all know in the specific best stories that they're not going to be these PG type stories, right? And we see Netflix what are the most popular? They draw the line. They go to a certain level, and it's creativity. You did that. So where can we purchase the book and learn more about you? And I know you're excited about Miami as well.
I'm super excited. I've actually never been to Miami. So okay. I am really excited because I know what a great literary town it is. And I'm excited to see all the people at the book fair there. And you can get the book at the Miami Book Fair and certainly at any independent bookstore. The Vintage has done a really good job about getting it into bookstores. So or IndieBound is a great place to order online from independent bookstores, or Powell.
Well, you're fabulous, Andrea. Great story. You didn't give me any cookie cutter story, that's for sure, in our conversation. And you told a story that kept everyone interested. So you might have to write a book at one point about your journey as an author who knows where it's going next, right? From this, I'm sure they're already having you crank out another book, right? That's what happens. It'll another be 15 years now. Oh, you will see. I'm surprised. I thought, you know, after success like that, they're going to say, you've got to write another book.
I am working on something. What I'm working on is really, really, really different. So,
That's what you wanted, because that's because you went through all the study. You don't want to be typecast in, I don't know what you call bookcast, into the same type of story every time, because why did I go through all these years? But I appreciate you calling, and best of luck.
Thank you. Take care.
All right. Bye-bye. Bye. You're listening to Neil Haley's show. We'll be back in just a moment. Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Neil Haley Show's Author's Corner segment, the Miami Book Fair, November 17th to 24th. The Street Festival is 22nd and 24th. Go to miamibookfair.com for more information. We had our final warm-up in Pittsburgh. I always talk about this. By the time November comes, it's going to be freezing in my studios when I broadcast live on Sunday with Eric Remmel from Life Improvement Radio, another year, 10 years in Miami, only one time. I have attended myself every time. Rest has been in the studio, but talking to amazing authors. So I'm excited to welcome the program today, Susan Richards Shreve, author of More News Tomorrow. How are you, Susan? Thanks for calling.
Great to talk to you. I'm great.
Let's get
in the rain.
I can hear the rain in my studios, right outside my studios. Let's kind of go right into specifically how you became an author. Tell us that story.
Well, I came from a storytelling family. There was constant competition at the dinner table. I always sort of lied about the stories that had happened to me every day so I could win the competition. And I really had always wanted to be a writer. I didn't get much encouragement from my academic people, but as I went along, I started writing books, and I wrote my first book when I was 18, and nobody wanted that.
Okay.
And then I wrote another and sold it.
Hey, so first one didn't work. Second one was the charm. What secrets did you offer for getting that opportunity? Did you just keep pounding on doors, or right place, right time? No,
well, I kind of did. I was very innocent about it. So I just thought all you needed to do was write a book, and then it would be on somebody's bookshelf. And I spent a long time between the first book that I wrote and the one that finally sold. So 10 years.
Wow.
And I knew it, not that it was going to sell. I had been certainly diminished by the years, but I knew that it was a lot better than the one that I'd written in the first place. So I gave it a shot, and it did sell. Selling in those days was at a very low option.
Right. It's changed. Isn't it amazing how publishing's changed and everything, and how you sell books has changed?
Everything has changed. And it's kind of wonderful in some ways and sort of dreadful in other ways. The wonderful part is that is a lot of people can get their stories out one way or another. I think that's good.
But there's an oversaturation of books. So you really have to.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, you really have to be differentiate yourself because that's what publishers are looking for, and stories that are going to have a built-in audience ready to go.
Exactly. But the number of built-in audiences are growing, and I certainly think that the emphasis on diversity is great.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And that's huge, because, I mean, now with the built-in audiences, because of social media, because of, you know, the World Wide Web in general, you can really find a niche audience that really could make a book take off.
Exactly. And that's wonderful. And when I started, that certainly was not true.
Exactly.
I benefited by being a girl, a woman, because it was a time for women, as it is again. And I benefited by the few books that were published every year.
All right. So let's kind of go into specifically More News Tomorrow. Why did you write the book?
I wrote the book. It actually came to me. Books sort of come in very surprising ways, I think, to a lot of writers. It came to me looking at a picture of my grandfather, who is Danish and owned a boys' camp in northern Wisconsin. And by the time I got downstairs to make coffee, he turned into a man who murdered his wife. He was a very, my real grandfather was a wonderful, lovely man. But somehow that picture sent me to writing about a boys' camp and a man who murders his wife.
Wow. Okay.
Yes. I don't want to think too much about that, Neil.
No, your brain, how it works. How did that go from there to there? So this was not a true story, or was a true story?
No, it was not a true story at all. The only true part of the story was that my grandfather owned a boys' camp, and that's where my mother grew up as a little girl.
And
so I heard a lot about it when I was a little girl.
Right, and just think of the mysteriousness of camps, right?
Exactly.
And how you can come up with characters and different ideas, and probably you're watching television or reading something that led you to the murderer, right?
Right. And I must admit, I went through books that I'd written, and this was my 15th book. And this was not the first time I had a murder.
But not always. your fans.
Not always. Then you would be seriously disturbed.
Hey, but that's okay, right? There's a genre right. out there for you right now, right? You know, with the
that's right.
with the whole the murderers, the serial killers. With
I think everybody's sort of fascinated by that, terrified and fascinated, and me too.
Yeah, and they're wondering why that kids develop to adults to become sociopaths or again
exactly.
or serial killers. And it's very interesting that Netflix show, and it'll come to me in a second. It's brilliant, the ability how they really studied the FBI, studied specific serial killers and what made them tick and what was the reason right. that it happened. And it has, and this is the funniest thing, not funny, but funny in a certain way, is people think, well, you know what, as long as I'm not abusing somebody with violence, meaning hitting and beating, I'm going to be fine. That's okay to use words, when words are the biggest thing that can cause kids to become who they are at the end of their lives, meaning the
exactly
point, that it's, thing. It's how you talk to people that could just destroy them. Yeah,
exactly. And in this particular book, it's a murder of passion. It's not he's not a murderer.
We have before us the opportunity to forge a new world order.
There is a man behind the curtain. This isn't the Wizard of Oz. The shakeup to the music business machine.
That sounds fun!
This is a far more deadly predator than anyone ever imagined.
Perfectly designed.
I wonder which came first.
Cyberstation USA.
Cyberstation USA is the future of radio. Get your business into the online future at the world's largest internet radio station. From banner placement on our homepage to any of our broadcaster stages, commercials on our video player, audio spots on any of our shows, or at the beginning of any of our on-demand broadcasts. Cyberstation USA offers competitive rates with a worldwide reach, a fully integrated one-stop shop social media broadcast platform. For more information, please contact our sales department at cameo@cyberstationusa.com.
Cameo Entertainment Group and CyberStation USA are now part of Stitcher, a free radio app for your smartphone. With Stitcher, you can listen to live programming as well as archive radio programming right on your phone. To obtain Stitcher, just go to the App Store for your particular phone. Go to search, then type in Stitcher. That's Stitcher. S-T-I-T-C-H-E-R.
S-T-I-T-C-H-E-R.
Then download. It's that simple. Stitcher, a free radio app for your smartphone. Convenient access to live and archive CyberStation USA programming on your mobile phone. That's Stitcher.
S-T-I-T-C-H-E-R.
CyberStation USA.
Always on the go.
Every so often you have technology come along that rewrite the rules of the game.
Digital culture isn't characterized by the home computer.
You speak instantly to a man standing on the shore of France.
The cyberstation, the USA, the .com.
Worldwide.
Everything has changed.
A new age.
The biggest ride in all of history.
This is cyberstationusa.com.
Worldwide.
This is the future.
The future.
Radio.
The future.
The future.
The future of radio.
And that really is the message.
And you never really find out if he did it because his daughter doesn't believe he did.
We don't want to spoil it. We just want to, I think yes, the big thing of you writing it is to think about the camp and the boys camp,
yeah.
but make it interesting by putting a murderer out there and a crime of passion, which I don't even want to know how many crimes of passion there are a year, right? We don't have a lot of studies. You just have to watch crime scene investigation shows, or even, there's a channel, the ID channel on Discovery or something. You're going to find crimes of passion all the time.
The market is flooded.
The motive. So what's been the feedback with the book?
The feedback actually has been really terrific. And I didn't know. You never know. You don't know whether you'll touch a chord or not. I think it's the best written book. It's very tight. But why it has had this response, I really don't know, but it's pleased me. There's no, and by response, I mean the reader-to-writer response, the letters I've gotten. You know, I am a slightly extreme writer, and I never know how a book will be received. And also through the years, I've gotten to be a better writer.
Well, you get better after that. And hey, your challenge is to get that first published to now how many books you've written. Congrats on that. And I can see
you
love it and you can't wait to be in Miami. And everyone that could check you out, get that autograph book and get to talk to you and your mind and how it works, right? To come up with a killer.
It'll be fun. I'm really looking forward to it.
All right. Best place we can find info on you and purchase your book and learn more about you, Susan. Where can we go?
Amazon. Any bookstore that might carry it. You never know which ones do. But you know, you can go online and get it.
All right.
It'll be out in paper this coming summer.
Fabulous. Well, I appreciate you calling. Thanks for coming on the show and take care.
Thanks so much. Bye.
Okay, bye-bye. You'll listen to Neil Haley Show. We'll be back in just a moment.
We're back to the Neil Haley Show on the Author's Corner segment, and I love working with Triumph Books. And I wish I could have more time to talk sports all the time. Maybe I want to wear his shoes, but again, I'm sure that he couldn't wear my shoes at size 15 and a former professional wrestler. So I'm excited to welcome to the program Zach Jackson, author of 100 Things the Browns Fans Must Do and Live and Die. You know, the whole 100 Things brand. How are you, Zach? And thanks for calling.
Well, I'm better than the Browns at this current moment, but thanks for having me.
Yeah, but see, you're better. But see, here's the thing. The Browns beat the Ravens. The Steelers are almost in the same boat as the Browns, except Browns' expectations were much higher this year.
Well, this is the best Browns team since the 1980s, and this is the weakest AFC North that it's ever been in, what, 15 years or so of existence since they reshuffled 17 years, I think it is. So, you know, that's where the angst is. And it's still October, and the Browns' schedule gets really, really weak, you know, thanks in part to the Bengals' complete incompetence and Big Ben being out. But the way the Browns are playing right now, they, you know, there's no gimmies against anybody. So, you know, there's a scenario where 8 wins the division and the Browns can get there, but they're a long way from thinking that they can run 3 or 4 off, because it's just been a struggle to build on anything.
Well, I agree with you, but I ultimately think that if you got killed by the 49ers, the Steelers are better than you. We're better than them, because, again, the Steelers have messed up 3 times, and, you know, you could have a different record, and the Steelers would be talking Super Bowl with a third-string quarterback. So, again, we did not get killed at all except by the Patriots. Every game has been close, and that if you want to look at that, but also ultimately the Steelers could be 1-15 at the end of the year and lose every close game, because Mike Tomlin does not know how to win close games. So we're in deep trouble as much as you are as well. But the expectations, all the different things, but I think it's the Browns curse that continues, and I'm sure that's in 100 things. The curse of just, which Browns team is this?
Well, let me tell you what's in the book is relates to this conversation, and obviously Browns and Steelers is special to a lot of people. The winningest quarterback in First Energy Stadium, which was known as Cleveland Brown Stadium, which opened in 1999, the quarterback who's won the most games there is Ben Roethlisberger.
Yeah.
That tells you a whole lot about the Browns, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, so it's you know, to me, I went back and forth with the editor on this one, actually, because to me, obviously you don't want to dwell on the negative when you're trying to sell Browns books, right?
Yeah.
But that is like one of the top 3 things that sums up the first 2 decades of this new Browns organization. So, you know, the Browns are much better. I'm not completely surprised that they've had, you know, growing pains and struggles here early, just because so much is new. So many players are new. They're still a young team. But, you know, the extent of the thing, when you look at their offensive pieces, they should be much better than they've been. So we'll see how that goes. But they play the Steelers on November 14th and on December 1st. And I don't care if Devlin Hodges or who's playing for the Steelers. Beating them is a hump that the Browns have to get over. This talk is just talk until that happens. It really is. And they took care of business a little over a week ago by going to Baltimore, a place that only won four times in 20 years, and dismantling the Ravens. And so regardless of what happens these next few weeks, they need to beat the Steelers in November and December to kind of say that they've turned the corner and going forward, because it is about going forward. The Browns are good, and maybe next year they can win something. This year is going to be a learning year.
So basically the book is not about the old Browns, only the new Browns then.
I wouldn't say only, it's focused on the new Browns. Things that you can't tell the story of the Browns without are in there. And that's obviously the Hall of Famers going back to Jim Brown and Otto Graham. That's obviously the 80s Browns with Bernie, who were so popular and came so close and didn't get there, and are probably the biggest reason why the Browns only disappeared for 3 years, why the NFL realized they made a mistake, right, and brought this team back. So the unfortunate thing is, for most of these 20 years, this is season 21 that we're 5 weeks into, they've remained an expansion team. They've just been bad. They've been incompetent with drafting. Right. They've changed everything. They're their third owner. They had started 30 quarterbacks in 20 years, and that's just absolutely astounding.
And that just shows about the before Browns of that time. They were a very consistent, well-managed organization, except probably firing Bill Belichick. If you look at it back, that is one of the...
Well, the Ravens fired Bill Belichick. Yeah.
Right, okay. Well, we'll go with that. And I remember those Browns for sure. I remember traveling out and listening to the Browns starting to build a brand and almost beating the Steelers at that time, and there was a certain time period. It looks like history's repeating itself in the old division, the Central Division, where you looked at the Browns and Steelers that were kind of mediocre. The division wasn't very good at that time, and they were battling each other to win the division.
And I think that's what makes this AFC North unique, even as the league changes and the world has changed, right? Like, the Browns and Steelers is the forever rivalry. The Browns and Bengals is the in-state forever rivalry that dates back to everybody that remembers Paul Brown, right? And the Browns and Ravens were the same organization. And the Steelers and Ravens have developed this blood rivalry through the years. So I think that's what makes it special. And like I said, it's an important – I don't care if the Steelers do go 2-14 this year. It's an important step for the Browns to say they're back in the living, breathing NFL, is to beat the Steelers, and specifically if they can sweep them this season.
All right. Okay. Well, and so interesting. So you talked about the old – you had to put in the 100 things – the old Browns, the new Browns. So I like talking old Browns because, again, one of my clients, by the way, is Anthony Griggs, who played in the Drive in 1986 and played for the Eagles as well.
Right.
And so the Drive was one of my favorite things, because my second favorite team next to the Steelers are the Broncos. So the Drive and Drive 2 have to be in your book.
You can't tell the story of the Browns without the Broncos. You can't. And I thought last year, the Browns going to Denver on a national TV Saturday night game and knocking the Broncos out of the playoffs, I thought that was a key thing for them, right? The Browns didn't end up making the playoffs, but they ended the Broncos' chances, and they really scored a big road win there. And, you know, part of the angst with the Browns and the frustration right now as we speak in early October is that winning 7 games last year was such a big deal here, right? Because they had won 4 over the previous 3 seasons.
And they didn't win any games 1 year. So there you go.
Right. So I don't want to say, like, lack of respect, because I think that's too much for the process of getting to, you know, being 9-7 and how difficult that really is. But I just think people turned their expectations on turbo, right? And, of course, like, finally you had a quarterback. You went and got Odell Beckham. Like, Myles Garrett is one of the 5 most talented defensive players in the league. Like, to a certain level, the expectations are real. However, you just look around this league and you don't get anything. And if you have a 9 or 10 win season, you have earned it. You've been a really good team. You know, what happens in January, how you stay healthy, how you got there, you can debate and analyze that stuff. But it takes a really, really good team to have a winning record in this league, no matter the schedule you play, no matter the circumstances, because there's so much parity, because there's so many good players. And it is just hard to be really good in this league, first of all, and then harder to maintain it.
Yes. highlight the losing season, not winning a game, I'm sure, is in the 100 things. Yes. And you know what? But again, people still take that as the greatest thing because we all remember. I don't know how old you are, Zach. I remember the days when the Saints were the Aints, and then they had the paper bags on their heads. I didn't know how many. I don't think the Browns wanted to hide their faces, their fans, compared to the Saints, where they all had paper bags on their heads. And I don't think the Saints didn't lose all their games.
Well, you know, nobody goes 16-0, right? It hasn't happened in my lifetime. Well, the Patriots did. They didn't go 19-0.
Right.
So it's happened once in my lifetime. Only two teams have ever gone 0-16 because it's just not supposed to happen. It's just not. And then specifically in the context of going 3-13, 1-15, then 0-16. Like, you go 1-15, you're supposed to bounce back the next year. You're not supposed to completely hit rock bottom. And they did. So the book starts with the Browns' one playoff appearance back in 0-2. They led the Steelers by 17. They squandered it. They haven't been back since. And we know 0-2 was a long, long time ago. From there, it goes to the quarterback history of the new team, basically saying the old.
We have before us the opportunity to forge a new world order.
There is a man behind the curtain. This isn't the Wizard of Oz. The shakeup to the music business machine.
That sounds fun!
This is a far more deadly predator than anyone ever imagined.
Perfectly designed.
I wonder which came first.
CyberStation USA.
CyberStation USA is the future of radio. Get your business into the online future at the world's largest internet radio station. From banner placement on our homepage to any of our broadcaster stages, commercials on our video player, audio spots on any of our shows, or at the beginning of any of our on-demand broadcasts. CyberStation USA offers competitive rates with a worldwide reach, a fully integrated one-stop shop social media broadcast platform. For more information, please contact our sales department at cameo@cyberstationusa.com.
Cameo Entertainment Group and CyberStation USA are now part of Stitcher, a free radio app for your smartphone. With Stitcher, you can listen to live programming as well as archive radio programming right on your phone. To obtain Stitcher, just go to the App Store for your particular phone. Go to search, then type in Stitcher. That's Stitcher. S-T-I-T-C-H-E-R.
S-T-I-T-C-H-E-R.
Then download. It's that simple.
Stitcher,
a free radio app for your smartphone. Convenient access to live and archive CyberStation USA programming on your mobile phone. That's Stitcher.
S-T-I-T-C-H-E-R.
CyberStation USA.
Always on the go.
Every so often you have technology come along that rewrite the rules of the game.
Digital culture isn't characterized by the home computer.
You speak instantly to a man standing on the shore of France.
The CyberStation, the USA, the .com.
Worldwide.
Everything has changed.
A new age.
The biggest ride in all of history.
This is CyberStationUSA.com.
Worldwide.
This is the future.
The future.
Radio.
The future.
The future of radio.
And that really is the message.